listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Brian Callen Hunter Mott Show. We have a gentleman on that we've been trying to get for a long time, Dr. Paul Ekman. He's written, really, honestly, too many books for me to read, but I have read Emotions Revealed and Telling Lies, Clues to Deceit. But then there's Unmasking the Face, there's Why Kids Lie, it just goes on and on. How many books have you read, Doctor?
Well,
I mean written. 15, I'm sorry, written. How many books have you written?
15 books.
15.
I'm just
15.
Finishing my 16.
The man is busy. Even after retiring as a professor at UCSF, you continue to write and continue to do your work. We just had Dacher Keltner on, who was one of your students.
Yes.
And his book is great. But he dedicates a chapter to your experience in Papua New Guinea, which I think got you started on being able to read faces. I think you've logged over 10,000 human expressions.
Yes, I have. But yeah. Let me just think for a moment. Yes, the New Guinea work came before developing a complete catalog of facial expression.
But you were one of the first people to come back with evidence that even though a tribe had been so isolated and had no experience, no contact with Western civilization, they shared the same expressions for disgust, happiness, pain. What would I can't remember.
Fear, anger, sadness, disgust. Those were the same. I didn't study more than six emotions at that time. And
right.
Fortunately, an anthropologist who was convinced I was totally wrong went to a different area of New Guinea, just as remote. And he first stopped at my lab, and I gave him all the research materials and showed him how he could conduct the experiments because he was convinced it would prove me wrong. And he got exactly the same results. So that's ideal. That is, when you get an antagonist willing to go to the work to try to prove you wrong and they get the same results, that's precious evidence that rarely occurs in psychology.
Was it a surprise to you when you found, when you came to your...
Oh, no. By then I knew it. A neuro... what should I call him? A neurologically based pediatrician, Carlton Gajdacek, who holds the distinction of being the only Nobel Prize winner to ever be convicted of a felony, but that's a separate story.
What was the felony?
Carlton had been in that area of New Guinea studying a particular neurological disease called Kuru, and he had realized that documenting the behavior of people who literally were still using stone implements would be just as valuable. And those were the glory days of NIH, and he had a lot of money, and he hired a cinematographer, and they took over 100,000 feet of color film. And they never looked at it, but when he heard of my interests, he lent me the film. And it took me about 6 months to go through it, but I never saw an expression I hadn't seen in this culture. So a mark one for Darwin and a minus for Margaret Mead.
And yeah.
Whenever I could, from the context, figure out what the emotion was, my reading of it was perfectly accurate. Now, if I had been an anthropologist or an ethologist, I would have stopped then and just published what I told you. But as an experimental psychologist, I needed better evidence, not subject to any possible unwitting bias. But so I was quite convinced of what I would find. The only thing I didn't know was whether I'd be able to figure out how to conduct an experiment with people who didn't have a written language and who had never seen a photograph or a film before. I didn't know whether they'd be able to make sense out of visual images.
Right.
But I went twice. And in between the first and second visit in 1967 late 67 before I went back in 68, I figured out how to do that kind of research with people without a written language by adopting a procedure that a psychologist who had studied young children who also don't have a written language many years earlier, and it was the procedure I used, and it worked like mad. I would have a translator read to these people a very short story, like this person's child has died, and then I would put out three photographs, one of sadness, one of fear, one of anger, as judged in literate cultures, and ask them to point to the photograph that fit it. And lo and behold, not to my surprise, they pointed to this sad photograph.
It's amazing.
You read them a story, this person's about to fight, they pointed to the anger photograph. And on it went.
So and by the way, this was when I remember Steven Pinker wrote a book called The Blank Slate. And this was when a lot of that was sort of rather taboo. I mean, your findings were, you know, for the most part, we were always, well, human beings are a blank slate, and whatever you put on them, that was the orthodoxy. That was the religion of the day.
Glad to be challenging it.
Oh, I bet.
And Margaret Mead wrote a very long review criticizing me and trying to discard the findings. But they've stood up over time, and particularly because Carl Heider, the anthropologist, had repeated the work trying to prove it wrong. I mean, that gives you such a solid basis. Very rarely happens in the human sciences that anybody bothers to repeat anyone else's work, let alone an opponent bothers to try to show you wrong.
Yeah.
So I was very pleased to get those findings.
Thank God, that was a long time ago.
I mean, that was 1968, all the findings were published in 72 to 74, and I've gone to other things.
Yeah, but they've made a TV show based on your work. They made a TV show called Lie to Me. You've become pretty much of a celebrity. I mean, at least your work is you know.
And most recently, you consulted with Dacher Keltner on Inside Out.
Yeah.
Yes, that's true. Now, people either regard me as the human lie catcher or the face reader or both.
Yeah.
And I have developed, at the taxpayer's expense, since all of my research was done supported by NIH.
National Institute of Health, yeah.
Yeah, so I developed a lot of expertise in being able to see the fine details of what's in the face, what's in facial expression, and in being able to spot lies, but only if the stakes are very high. If the person could lose their reputation, their money, their job,
their freedom,
if they were caught, and if it's the first time they've told that lie, and they haven't had a chance to practice it a lot with a coach.
Mm. So help us do that. How do we? What are the first things you look for in a face?
Well, it has to be under those circumstances. Remember,
right. So if I've got somebody...
Paradoxically, if the stakes are low, if it doesn't matter... I was on a television show 25 years ago, and they said, well, I was born in Boston. Am I telling you the truth or lying? I said, all right, well, empty your wallet, not the company's, but your wallet on the table. All right, now, say it again, and I'll... If I catch you, I get everything that's in your wallet.
Oh, that's good. Oh,
so
then
sure enough, with the higher stakes, I could see some signs of concealed emotions and spotted the lie.
What do people do? Give us an example.
Well, in that case, it was a microfacial expression. But in my book, Telling Lies, I list over 30 different signs of lying, some in the body, some in the voice, some in the speech, many in the face. The face is the single best source, but if you only use the face, your accuracy rate is 70%. Well, that'll get you published, but it's of no practical use.
Yeah, and in that book, you talk about how you've heard the CIA and those kinds of institutions are using your work, but you don't know if they're using it properly because they've never really consulted you. Is that
true?
Well,
they have consulted me, but they haven't told me what they're doing.
I see.
And I never got involved. I'm very firmly opposed to anything that even borders on torture. I advocate humane interviewing, which I believe can be quite successful because everyone has a story to tell. If they want to, if you can convince them that you're not biased, that you really want to understand their viewpoint and why they did whatever it is they did, it's just amazing. Most people, over 90%, will tell you the truth.
If you validate their emotions.
Yes, and you, but you have to be willing to spend time. You're not going to figure it out in 5 minutes or a half hour. It may take you a few hours.
Mm-hmm.
But the high-stake cases, some of which I've been involved in, some criminal cases and some financial cases, that it's worth it to spend the time. And it certainly, I completely am opposed to and any use of high pressure, anything that borders on, let alone is torture. And our government engaged in torture under the Bush administration. Now, I can understand that they felt desperate, but even when you feel desperate, there are lines you shouldn't cross, and torture is one of them. And not only because it's wrong morally, that's sufficient, but it also can give you a lot of false information.
Yeah, it doesn't work a lot of times.
That's right, and you never know which is which.
Yep.
So better put in the time, do the humane interviewing, and you'll get very good results. Now, we live in an impatient culture where people want answers fast. And so that's one of the things that led to the use of torture. I'm ashamed to say that it was figures high up in the American Psychological Association who designed this torture program and got paid for it. In today's email, I got an apology, as did every other member of the American Psychological Association, for the association having been so complicit in torture. And it was. Now, they say they have now set up safeguards so that won't happen again. It shouldn't have happened in the first place. And what American people don't know but should feel proud of is that the people who first blew the whistle on the use of torture in Afghanistan and Iraq were Navy officers, Navy lawyers who saw what was going on and said, "We won't participate. This is wrong."
Mm.
So we should be proud of them.
I think so, too. And you know, I remember when we were doing what was called extraordinary rendition.
Oh, yeah,
taking people and putting them, flying them, really, to countries that didn't have the kinds of laws we do against torture and turning them over to the local authorities accidentally on purpose or whatever. So there was a lot of behavior that, you know, in hindsight, well, even then, was pretty shameful. And I hear what you're saying.
And I think in terms of your work as well, I mean, you know, showing the universality of emotions, right? It's not – once you recognize that, you can predict emotionally how, you know, your opponents will react. You knew how that was going to be perceived by the Iraqi people and the damage that would do to the U.S. effort there.
Well, even whether it will do damage or not, it's wrong.
Right.
Democracy, I think all democracies have to have moral principles at their core.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I couldn't agree more.
If they don't, then, you know, they're really not worth sustaining.
Well, they can't be there just when it's convenient. You know, I was always told as a kid, you it's hard to behave like a gentleman when you don't feel like a gentleman, you know?
Good statement.
Yeah, that's exactly right. What caused you to get so deeply involved, though, in just logging these thousands of micro-expressions? I was just thinking about the tedium, that work. It must have been fascinating, but there was a lot of work involved. I mean, the amount of observation.
Well, I liked work. I liked to work. And it was an enormous... Can you imagine? It's almost unimaginable, the challenge that that I faced. Here was facial expression, this most fascinating thing that we see all the time. And no one had figured it out.
I know, that's incredible.
It was waiting for me. It was how could I resist the opportunity to take what was still in the hands of the charlatans and the fakers and make use science to unpack it? What a wonderful opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, your legacy is pretty profound. I mean, it'll your work, you know, Ekman's work is what you hear about, and people are going to piggyback off this stuff. I mean, you know, you've done all that work. It must have been pretty satisfying to kind of realize the minute
it was enormously satisfying. Yeah. And those were the days when our country was investing in research.
Mm-hmm.
In those days, half of the grants submitted were funded in the behavioral area. Now it's about 3%.
Really?
Yes.
3%?
Yeah. Obama, who I favor in some ways, I'm extremely critical of for his having cut all of the funding with the joyous collaboration of Congress for behavioral science research. It just isn't there. And I tell students, if you want to live the American dream in behavioral research, go to England or Germany. You can't do it here.
There became this sort of strange stigma on behavioral research. Even my parents, who, you know, were sort of they're fairly libertarian, but certainly more Republican leaning. You know, my mother would always say, well, he's a sociologist, you know, with his beard, and he thinks he knows it all. And, you know, there was this idea that they thought they could restructure human society, and it was kind of like, that's what the Soviets did and what the Nazis did, and we have to be careful of all these academics coming up with these ideas on human nature. We know human nature already, and I wonder if that plays a factor into why we stopped funding all these sort of programs and things.
Well, I think that was partly it, and I think another part is that this doesn't account for Obama, but it does for the Republican Congress. Most psychologists are Democrats.
Is that true?
Yeah.
That's strange. I wonder why that is.
Well, what draws you into this strange field in the first place?
Asking why?
Might be some problem in understanding your own life or the life of important people around you. Otherwise, you wouldn't be drawn to psychology. Different for neuroscience. People drawn to neuroscience are there because this is the biggest puzzle that we face, is figuring out how the brain works, and we still don't have the right tools to get terribly far. We've made I think we're about 10% into it, and we're stuck. We don't have new tools to examine brain activity. They'll come, but I don't know when. So it's a field. When I chose to become a psychologist in the 1950s, very big problems were being studied by psychologists. Prejudice by Gordon Allport, intergroup conflict by Sharif, group dynamics by the Michigan group. I mean, these were huge societal problems. And psychology made some progress. We didn't solve the problems, but we understand them better now than we did some time ago. But producing societal change psychology works with individual and small group behavior. It doesn't deal with political institutions and how you change them. So even, you know, getting my findings used was not an easy matter, even despite my publishing them and making them available. These days, findings, what I've been doing since I retired, is developing online training tools that convert what I discovered into things that anybody can learn. Anyone can learn to spot a micro expression using one of my online interactive tools in under an hour. In less than an hour, schizophrenics can become equal to normal in understanding facial expression.
Where do they go for that?
My website, paulekman.com, and just good. Click on micro expressions, and you can learn how to do this. And lots of scientists, because we make the tools available to any scientist, student, or faculty, without cost. So there's been a lot of research.
Have you ever had to deal? How would one read a sociopath? I would imagine that's a very hard face to read.
No, it isn't, because sociopaths have the same emotions. They just feel them about different things. They don't care whether you're hurt. They care whether they are hurt.
Oh.
Now, none of us want to get hurt or treated badly, but that's all the sociopath. The sociopath has no compassion, no concern for the welfare of others. The rest of us do. So they're not very good liars, but they're very charming.
Oh.
I know that I'm talking to a psychopath or sociopath if I want to invite them home to dinner after only 20 minutes.
That's so amazing. That's amazing.
There's a lesson out there, ladies. Right?
Yeah.
You know, the other issue is, I believe that, and I think it's a really important issue, is most of us get misled because we don't want to know the truth. Do you want to find out that your spouse or lover is cheating on you? Do you want to find out that your kids are using hard drugs? Do you want to find out that the person you recommended for a job is embezzling from the company? Well, rationally you do, but psychologically you don't want to know that, and you unwittingly collaborate in being misled. That's why we have a common observation that the person who's being cheated on, everyone else knows it. They're the last to see it.
Yeah.
Because it's very painful news, and we avoid painful news.
That's for sure. That's for sure. I mean, just being honest with yourself is always a difficult thing. I see a lot of people who, especially in this business, in the acting business, I've always said if you're an acting teacher, the best thing you could do, the best critique you could use for most people who come to LA is quit. Quit and go home. It'll just save them 20 years of pain. But, you know, they're not going to see it. They're just not going to see it, man.
Did you ever run into an acting professor at the Tisch School in New York named Richard Shetner?
Richard Shetner, no. I know the Tisch School, but no. I've had acting teachers that can see if you're lying very quickly. They're very good at that stuff.
I, under Schechner's sponsorship, taught actors at the Tisch School about 20 years ago. Actors are a lot of fun to teach about how the face works because they don't get self-conscious.
Mm.
They like you're paying attention to their face. They don't get embarrassed by it.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Well, and I think that's the thing. It's, you know, we're now seeing a lot more interdisciplinary work, and it's strange, actually, that, you know, your work has not made more inroads into the world of acting because, you know, what more important research could there be for an actor?
Well, acting, though, is, you know, they'll always just say, if you tell the truth, everything else takes care of itself. And typically, as you know, get more in touch with your emotions, and more importantly, when you really listen to somebody, if you really key into somebody, and I had a teacher one time who said, look for something new every time you walk into a room, in the actor's face or in the room, and it'll put you in a certain state, a heightened state of awareness. I never thought of that, but it really does work. So a lot of that is, as an actor, you want to work on instinct. And I'd imagine there's a lot of that, doctor, that we take for granted, but there's a lot we see in the blink of an eye. There's a lot we see instinctually, isn't there?
Well, that's true. I always thought that the main use of my work for actors was for the director, because it gave them some tools. You know, if they have a sense you didn't get that just right, this gives them the tool to at least on the facial side know what was wrong. I had an interesting correspondence with Ingmar Bergman about one of his films in which I was presumptuous enough to tell him that I thought he had the lead actress, whose name escapes me at the moment. He married her at one point.
Oh, the Swedish actress?
Yes.
Come on, everybody should know this. I can't believe
I do know it. There's here, five spouses. Elsa Fisher, yeah. Ellen Lundstrom, Gundgrunt, Kebby Laratai, Ingrid von Rosen.
No, that's it.
You haven't hit it.
No.
In any case, he was trying to have her show fear in that scene, according to my reading of the scene, and she showed anguish. So I wrote him about what the difference was between the two and where the mistake was. And we had a very nice correspondence. He enjoyed it, and he appreciated being able to take apart. And if I had been there on the set with him, I would have been able to tell him, that eyebrow shouldn't have gone down, should have stayed up, that type of thing.
Was it Liv Ullmann?
Yes, it was Liv Ullmann.
That's right, Liv Ullmann. Now, what is the, I'm trying to think of, you just reminded me of something there. Boy, I can't remember now, darn it.
Well, I was going to ask you, Professor, I mean, one of the things that, you know, you may not believe in torturing others, but it seems from your work you certainly believe, like, torturing yourself. I remember in Emotions Revealed, you talked about sticking your face full of needles and then electrically stimulating the different muscles in your face.
Yes, but, you know, but that wasn't trying, that was trying to get at the truth about how the muscles work.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, but it certainly doesn't sound very pleasant.
It wasn't pleasant, but, you know, there was something also quite romantic about it. You know, what are you willing to do for science?
Absolutely. And one of the interesting things you found, right, is that as you programmed in the certain combination of facial muscles and made yourself feel that that facial expression, that then triggered in your body the actual feeling of the emotion.
Yeah, that was amazing to me. I was really quite unexpected, because I had thought of the face as a display system. But, you know, Stanislavski also said, make the movement, the feeling will follow. And that's exactly what we found. If you put on your face one of the configurations that we have found is universal to emotion, well, the changes in your brain and body occur involuntarily. So the face is an emotion generation system. And advertisers make use of that enormously, because when they show a product, they typically show it in the context of a smiling face. Now, even though it's a photograph, it's built into us to imitate the expression we see. And when we imitate a smiling face, we turn on the physiology of enjoyment, and that gets associated with a product.
That makes
sense.
So
that's very useful for the advertiser.
Yeah, we call it assuming the position in acting sometimes, where you may not feel like crying, but if you make the face and you act like you're going to cry, you can get yourself going. So
that's absolutely right. Yeah. And you lose control over it.
Yeah.
And
what is the difference between fear and anguish in the face?
Oh.
I mean, it's detailed.
I'll do it descriptively rather than in the technical terms we use. In anguish, the inner corners of the eyebrows are drawn up in the center and pulled together. In fear, the eyebrows are, both the inner and outer corners are raised and pulled together, so they form a straight, high line above the eyes.
Ooh.
In anguish, the eyelids are relaxed and begin to droop. In fear, the eyelids are raised high, exposing the sclera or white area above the iris. Those are the biggest differences, but they are very big differences.
Yeah, a huge difference. It must be kind of like nails on a chalkboard when you know the face so well and you see an actress doing anguish. You're like, no, that's fear. It's so obvious.
Right. Well, that's why it's fun to train them, because they want to learn.
Sure.
And it also gives the director of vocabulary to be able to speak more explicitly about what they're looking for.
It's funny how the more, as a kid, I was obsessed with snakes, and I would see the poisonous snake would show up on screen, and I was like, that's a python! It's a ball python! It's a really harmless snake! I have one as a pet, for God's sake, man! You know, you can. The more you know, the more sensitive you become to information.
Now, you may not know this. One of the things that Darwin reports doing in his expression book is going to the London Zoo and putting his face flat against the glass behind which was a python. And what he tried to do is every time the python would strike was not to flinch and pull back, and he couldn't do it.
Ooh, wow. Yeah, well, you know, snakes, primates are naturally afraid of snakes.
Well, I think most humans are too.
That's right, which they think is a genetic memory.
There are a few people who aren't. In almost everything you can think about a human being, you'll find a few who are not. But most are.
Well, I would say that people are not afraid of non-venomous snakes. I'm not afraid of non-venomous snakes. But I was in Costa Rica, and they have the Fer de Lance, and they have the Bushmaster. You get bit by those, you'll take about five steps and collapse. And that you get pretty vigilant. Anybody who's not afraid of a vipers like that is just not very intelligent. So I would say that there's a good reason to be afraid of a lot of snakes in certain areas of the world. So, you know, it makes sense. It's not a good way to die.
So, Professor Ekman, you know, based on all of that, who do you think are the most emotionally authentic actors out there? Whose work is, like, really top-notch?
Besides Brian Callen.
Besides who?
Professor, that's me, for God's sake, Brian Callen. This is an outrage, sir. I can't believe you don't know my work as well as I know yours. This is outrageous. All right, you're forgiven.
On the 14th and 15th of October.
All right. Well, we're going to take you to dinner if you have time. I'll take you to the best restaurant in L.A., and if you like good wine, I'm springing for it. So.
All right. Well, on the 14th, that would be excellent.
There you go. We're doing it. I can't wait.
Yeah.
So, just mention
why I'm there, because maybe it's a meeting you might want to attend.
Oh, yes.
I've been working and writing with the Dalai Lama now for the last 15 years. Hmm. We have co-authored a book, and we continue to see each other. I just, I'm almost done creating a map of the emotions at his request. That he said that when you wanted to get to the new world, you needed a map to get there. So we need a map of the emotions so we can get to a calm state of mind. And I've been working on that for almost 2 years now. But a separate issue is his concern that much of the entertainment that's available to children emphasizes the wrong values. It emphasizes exploitation and aggression rather than compassion and cooperation. So at his request, I'm bringing together a group of people in the entertainment industry that he can talk to about what he hopes they'll develop more of for children. And that will be at 10 o'clock in the morning on October 15th in L.A. If you'd like to come to that meeting, I'd be glad to, if you think you're relevant to it, I'd be glad to send you an invitation.
We would love it. You can count on that. And then if you have time, we would love to take you to dinner.
Take me to dinner on the 14th, because I'll come down ahead of time. I'll never trust the airlines to be sure to get me there.
Yep.
What's the best email address?
We'll give it to you off air, because if I give you my email on air, I'll get inundated by a whole bunch of stuff. But I'll give you my phone number in email, and Hunter will do the same.
Absolutely.
That's fine.
Let me ask you, I know you probably have to go, and we'll wrap this up, but when you are watching presidential debates or a president give a speech, it must be very difficult for you not to be reading their face and seeing if they're lying or telling the truth.
Well, of course I'll do that. I have a large collection. I've videotaped and have kept going back to LBJ. So I probably have the biggest collection of presidential lies. But it's a complex issue. We want, as presidents, people who are capable of successful negotiations with both friendly and unfriendly leaders of other countries. That means to negotiate means not to put your cards face up.
Right.
It means that you have to have the skills of concealment and falsification, which is really lying.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, at the same time, we want them to be truthful to us. But in an open democracy, our enemies watch everything our political leaders say. So when they watch the head of our State Department, whose name is escaping me at the moment.
John Kerry.
Yes. Everything he says to us, our opponents also see. So can he be honest with us and give, then he'd have his cards face up.
Right, mm-hmm. Right.
So in an open society, it's a real dilemma. And we have to grant that our leaders may not always, what we don't want them to do is to lie to us for their own personal gain. And that's what it seemed that Nixon was doing. Not just, we would never have criticized him for misleading the Chinese or the Soviets. Fine, that's what a leader is supposed to be able to do. But to mislead us in order to enhance his own political position, that's getting close to crossing a line that we don't accept.
Right.
So it matters what is the motive. Always look for the motive behind the actions.
Right, right. Well, food for thought. And we appreciate your time, sir, and your work. And it's an honor to speak to somebody who's had such influence on the world and on the way we interact. So I appreciate
and it's,
it.
And we're really excited for the directions that your work is going in with,
yeah.
You know, now how it's informing, you know, the entertainment industry and also all of the stuff that's happening with the Dalai Lama. I think that's really exciting.
We'll be there October 14th and 15th for sure. 15th.
Well, that's great. I can tell you that I never understand why people say it's an honor. It's just... Well, I did. It was there, and I did it, and
yes,
I had fun doing it.
We honor the effort. Listen, it's a lot. Look, you have been influential, and it took enormous effort. Yes, it's what you do. Yes, you love doing it. But, you know, you have to always look at somebody who's been doing this for so long and had such an impact and has from – I didn't realize you're a very compassionate man. And you're a passionate guy. And I really appreciate, I don't know how old you are, sir, but I know that you've never lost your outrage at the injustices in the world. That is obvious. And I really appreciate somebody who has stayed, has kept cynicism at bay and seems still to be so hungry to make a difference. And I find that very, very inspiring.
And well, thank you very much. It is how I've led my life, and it's how I think. You know, I say to my kids, you want to lead your life in such a way that when you get to the end of it, you'll be able to say, well, what I did with the talents I had. I tried to leave the world at least a little bit better than I found it. You can't lead your life in such a way that you say, oh, give me another chance. I made a lot of mistakes. I should have done it differently. What was it all for? There are no second lives.
Yeah. Well, you know, when you speak that way,
time you have.
When you speak that way, you sound very young. And I mean that. So I find it very inspiring.
Good. I look forward to meeting in person.
I can't wait. And we'll end this podcast, but stay on the line so we can get your information. Or in fact, Hunter,
or I'll email it.
Hunter
I'll
will email you. I want to get all your information, sir, and we'll see you on the 14th.
Very good.
Thank you, Professor Ekman. Thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
We hang up. There it is, ladies and gentlemen. We bring you Dr. Paul Ekman.
A legend.
A legend.
In his own time.
A thinker. That's the kind of guest you get on this, the mother of all shows. I'm excited. I want to go to dinner with him.
I'm excited. I want to go to dinner with him,
yeah,
too.
I will buy a $200 bottle of wine.
Brian, that's...
I'll spend $500 on that dinner.
You'll spend $500?
Well, first of all, I like saying that so the listeners know that I got $500 to just throw away. You
it's
understand?
Not throwing away, though.
Sure
it's an investment.
Sure as hell isn't.
No, it isn't, because that's the thing.
No, I mean,
that,
it is.
Yeah,
it's
no,
it's
I
an
mean,
investment, yeah, yeah, in our brains.
Yeah, and also a great story. I mean, Brian, like, you've told so many stories, like, where you've taken, you know, credit for what people have said,
yeah,
and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But when you can actually tell a real story...
Well, let's put it this way. After October 14th, God help you if you mention the TV show Lie to Me. If you mention lying,
if you mention Inside
Dr.
Out,
Paul
Pixar,
Ekman, answer anything. Oh, funny you should say. I just had dinner with my friend, Dr. Paul Ekman.
Oh, you felt something the other day? That's interesting, because I just had dinner with Paul Ekman, who studies emotions.
I am very quickly becoming the most interesting man at the table.
You already are, Brian.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you like stand-up comedy, come see me. Check TFATK, fighterandkid.com, that's what it spells, or briancallen.com, and that is where my schedule is to make fun. And if you want to find Hunter Motz, well,
good luck.
he's a phantom.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.